Welcome to The Debrief, everyone. We begin tonight with the case of two federal prison guards facing federal charges over the death of millionaire pedophile Jeffrey Epstein.
A federal grand jury has charged the guards, Tova Noel and Michael Thomas, with one count of conspiracy and five counts of falsifying records. The U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York says the guards repeatedly failed to conduct mandated checks on inmates and lied on other official forms to hide their dereliction. The indictment alleges the guards failed to make counts at 4 p.m., 10 p.m., midnight, 3 a.m., and 5 a.m. leading up to Epstein's death, which was noticed at 6:33 a.m. The document also says the guards failed to make rounds every 30 minutes, and that Noel falsified more than 75 reports saying the rounds had been made. What were the guards doing? The indictment says for substantial portions of their shifts, the guards sat at their desk, browsed the internet, and moved around the common area. For 2 hours, they appeared to have been asleep. An assistant director at the FBI said the security risks created by the guards' alleged behaviors are immense.
With us tonight are attorneys Bernarda Villalona and Linda Kenny Bodden. So, Bernarda, look, this is a mess. A lot of people asking questions about whether or not Epstein committed suicide or not. And now we've got guards asleep at the wheel, literally. That's what the U.S. attorney is saying the surveillance footage shows in this case.
Yeah, I mean, the suspicions were there from the very beginning. Everybody's been suspecting that there's been some kind of foul play here. But here you have what definitely can be proven is that these correctional officers, that they falsified records and weren't paying attention to their duties on that day.
Linda Kenny Bodden, your husband, of course, involved with the case. We need to say that for ethics reasons. So, you know, when we look at the pure indictment, though, we've got accusations and we have admissions from these two guards saying that they screwed up.
Right. One of the guards says, don't blame her, meaning Michael Thomas was saying to about Tova Noel, don't blame her, I'm at fault. But for 8.5 hours, the way I read the indictment, Aaron, no one was monitoring anything that was going on with Epstein. 8.5 hours, and for 2 of those hours, both of them at the same time were asleep. I've never heard of such a thing.
So, Bernarda, where would we be in this case if we didn't have the surveillance footage for officials to go look and say, do the documents match what the cameras show?
Exactly. Well, that's the thing. That's the important thing about having the surveillance, because the surveillance disproves the documentation that were filed by both of these officers. Had there not been a camera, you don't know whether it's true or not, whether they actually went and checked on Mr. Epstein.
You know, when we look ahead, Linda, towards possible penalties here, if you have admissions, now we don't have an official plea yet, but you have admissions contained in the indictment itself. Do you anticipate these defendants having a hard time if they try to take this to trial, given the admission?
Well, it sounds like the prosecution wants to get certain admissions from them to go beyond specifically what they did. Because remember, in the indictment, it says that they had cameras to monitor the guards, but the two cameras that were on Epstein, the video was corrupted. So there's something that still raises questions, and maybe they want to know how that happened.
So is it possible then, Bernarda, that what we're looking at here is the old federal attempt to go after two people and then hope they flip and then potentially say something about a bigger issue?
Yes, that's what I'm assuming that's going to take place, because now we have charges where these two officers are facing some kind of penalty, whether it's probation or jail. So as an incentive, they can actually explain what actually happened and have their charges either dismissed or a lesser play.
And Linda Kenny Bodden, of course, we're speculating a little bit here, but it's not baseless speculation. This is the way it tends to go. We're looking at it as attorneys saying, we've seen this procedure before.
Right, and I've seen it because I've had represented families whose loved ones have hung themselves in jail.
And that's unfortunate when it happens. And look, we're potentially seeing some action now. Closing arguments. In another case, we're following the trial of a Florida man accused of quadruple murder. Prosecutors say Henry Segura killed his girlfriend, Brandy Peters, their 3-year-old son, and Peters' twin 6-year-old daughters. But Segura says Peters was a drug mule who was killed by a cartel who caught her stealing money. It's been a case of colorful witnesses, including this man, James Carlos Santos. He said in writing and on the witness stand that he recruited Brandy Peters, the victim, to be a drug mule. Her family said she did no such thing, and the state says Santos was lying on the stand. But Santos says he ordered a hit on Brandy Peters when he realized she was stealing from the cartel's cut of its profits off the drug trade. Segura himself took the stand to try to clear his name. He said he slept around behind his wife's back with victim Brandy Peters and other women who took the stand in this case because doing so to him was like a drug, he said. And at one point on the stand, he snapped back at the judge.
I told the lady Johnson, Investigator Johnson,
you told
over
her
the phone that I was cheating on my wife. I didn't want y'all to find out. Mm-hmm. And she excuse me, and she, like I said, she went back and forth, and we was arguing about, she know I killed my son, we're gonna arrest you for killing your son, and I hung up on him.
So your testimony is that you told police in this case over the phone,
Investigator Johnson.
Wait a minute, don't interrupt her question, Mr. Skirr. Let her finish her question.
She's asking the same question over and over.
Be quiet.
No, she's...
Be quiet. Now, she asks you a question.
Who are you pointing at?
You wait till she finishes her
I'm a grown man.
And then answer it, okay? Yeah. And she won't interrupt your answer either, because a court reporter can't take down two people at once. Is that clear? Yeah. Sir?
Yeah, that's very clear.
All right.
Back now to attorneys Linda Kenny-Bodden and Bernarda Villalona. So, Linda, we've talked about this before, and I think it's worth reviewing again. What was going on in that exchange?
Well, I mean, obviously, he got a little upset when he was trying to answer the question over and over again. The judge told him to stop. He couldn't talk over it, and he got kind of ticked off. I mean, and quite frankly, Aaron, you know, I would get ticked off, too, if I were in jail for 9 years for a crime I didn't commit. And as a lawyer, I've always wanted to talk back to a judge sometime.
Well, you know, Linda, you're a little more controversial than perhaps Bernarda or I would be. And Linda's of the impression that this guy's innocent. We just heard that. Bernarda, your take.
Well, I mean, I would flip it, go on the other side, is that he showed his true temper, his true demeanor. He showed who he was. Like, he told this job, I'm a grown man. Don't talk to me like that. And I think that same disrespect that he showed to the judge, the prosecution can argue and did argue that that is his true demeanor. He felt disrespected by Brandy.
Let's listen to the closing arguments now. The state started by arguing the murder of Brandy Peters was premeditated. Why? Because the state says Henry Segura brought a gun to the house. In the state's view, that's apparently enough to prove premeditation. Then the state went into motive with another guess, perhaps.
We know that Henry Segura owed child support to Brandy Peters. Mr. Segura already was owed child support on another child living in South Florida. But in this particular case, it's not only child support. He's got a six-figure job awaiting in Afghanistan if he can get that visa, but he can't. Ms. Peters is threatening him. I'm going to put you in jail. I'm going to take your IRS. I'm going to have all these liens against you, garnish your wages. She's taunting him, sending him text messages. He's forwarding it onto his wife. Keep in mind, 3 days before the murder, this taunting's occurring. He didn't think Javonte was his. Petitions the court back in June. Strong evidence support the kid is not his. And 4 months later, after he files that petition, they're all dead. Timing is everything. Who's got the means to do this? Who's got the strength to do that aspect? Who's got the anger to do those beatings in the manner that they were done? Who's got the strength to use a weapon in order to cave in her skull? Big guy, welder, deals with a lot of stuff that he has to do and carry things around. Metal, strong guy. Certainly has the anger and the frustration with Brandy Peters. Further, friend of his, lifelong friend of his, has previously seen him with a .32 caliber gun. The weapon that was used and shot in the house with 10 recovered projectiles is a .32 caliber. When do coincidences stop being coincidences?
The state, of course, says the motive was that $20,000 in unpaid child support. The debt legally prevented Segura from getting that six-figure job as a welder in Afghanistan, ironically enough, that would have allowed him to pay the debts. And the state says Segura lied about his whereabouts, then changed his story about the day of the killings.
Henry Segura, interview on November 20th, 2010, the day after the homicides occurred, the day they were discovered. I was home all day long. We now know that not to be true. So why lying to law enforcement? To cover up an affair after you just found out your son's dead? November 30th, 10 days later, he lied 23 times in that video alone. 23 times in that one alone. Nope, I was home. He goes farther than that. Check my cell phone. My cell phone say I'm at home. He challenges law enforcement. Check my cell phone. I'll tell you I was exactly where I said I was. Doesn't tell him about that 408-8669 number. He tells him that belongs to a friend of his. They confront him. We know you have a second phone. Oh, yeah, but I got rid of that long before Brandy was dead. Again, not true. Caught in a lie. At that point, does he come off and say, you know what, I've lied to you. Sorry. Trying to not mess up my marriage. I apologize. I was at her house. I had sex with her. Nope. Doesn't say that.
The defense told the jury not to believe the state's theory on motive. Other women in Segura's life testified that while he had trouble with them, he never did anything violent. Plus, bloody gloves, which turned up in a nearby trash can at a park, could have proven a link to the crime the defense suggested.
So there's a bunch of latex gloves that were discovered in this trash can, I think five or six of them. They're in evidence. They're defense exhibits in this case. Joellen Brown discovered another set of gloves. There were seven gray gloves that she found. Some of those also had blood on them. Blood was also identified by FDLE expert Diane Guzman in 2018 when the collared shirt that was found there was tested for blood for the first time. There was also a t-shirt with red-brown stains on it. That one did test negative for blood, but you can see on it that there's a puncture wound from which the red-brown stains emanate. And as Joellen Brown said, if you set something on fire, that can have the potential to ruin DNA, and it may test negative after that. There was an empty box of shop towels found. There was also a bleach bottle. All of the garbage was set on fire, right? That's why it's all burned up, because somebody set it on fire. I doubt any janitor that's cleaning those bathrooms is going to do all the cleaning, get blood all over everything, and then set it all on fire unless it's evidence of a crime. Why don't you just call the person who changes the trash can, right? You, the party with the burden of proof. If you want to exclude every reasonable doubt about whether this is related to the murder, why don't you just call the person who changes the trash can or get records from the city of Tallahassee to demonstrate that it was changed if you think that happened. They didn't do that. They don't have any evidence of that. They prefer to rely on conjecture.
The defense points to all these reasons why Henry Segura did not commit this crime. Foreign DNA in the house, foreign female DNA under the victim's fingernails, and shoe prints, which an expert for the defense said were from five different people. Plus, the defense says Brandy Peters was afraid of drug cartel member James Carlos Santos, who had warned Peters she was in danger.
Brandy knows best what Brandy's in danger from. You don't want to believe Santos? Don't believe Santos. Believe Brandy. Children were killed here. An innocent mother was killed here. She's got family. They deserve justice. Mr. Segura is a father and a brother and a son and a friend, and he deserves justice. Folks, justice can't start until the search for the right guy or right guys or right people starts. This has been 9 years in the coming. Mr. Segura has waited patiently for 9 years. I put him on the stand knowing he's not a superstar witness. All I told him was get up there and be real. But you've waited for this moment. Get up there and be real and be you. And they want to try and say because he gets frustrated that he's the killer. Is that your best evidence that he's the killer? He got frustrated? Look, as he told you himself on the stand, he's been in custody for 8 years for an offense he didn't commit. His frustration is not in any way evidence of guilt. It's evidence of a man who has waited for you for too long. You're the only ones who can deliver justice. You have the power to save. You have the power to take life. I ask that you follow the law that you promised to follow, that you hold the state to its burden, and that you find Mr. Segura not guilty.
On rebuttal, the state said the defense experts weren't telling the correct story, and regardless, that Segura lied and that lies equaled guilt.
If all that was said was true in Mr. Prince's argument, why did Henry Segura lie about being at the house on that day that many times? Why did Henry Segura set up an alibi with his phone, knowing full well that he was at his house? Why was her cell phone taken? The only thing out of this house that's been taken in this situation is her cell phone. Why? Because it was incriminating against him. Why is there only one void pattern in the blood spatter? One. A void pattern is a situation in which blood spatter is made and it is blocked by an object, specifically as we're talking about the person that perpetrated this event. There's only one void pattern. If there were more than one person, there would be more than one void spot, and there is not. There is one void pattern.
Let's go back to our experts now, Linda Candy Bodden, Bernarda Villalona. So Bernarda, do lies mean that he's having an affair he's trying to cover up, or do lies mean he's a killer who should be convicted? Both sides have completely different versions of that, obviously.
Yeah, well, obviously the prosecution is using that his lies are all reasons why he is guilty because they're able to disprove his lies and that he was lying because he was guilty and he wanted to hide the fact. Unfortunately for the prosecution, the defense did a great job by saying that the reason that he's lying is because he's covering up the affairs, which is a plausible reason.
Yeah, we've got plausible arguments here. Linda, I know what your theory is. Your theory is that he lied to try to cover up the affair and he's not the killer.
So, well, look, it makes a lot of sense because here's the problem. The prosecution has no evidence, right? They don't have any DNA. DNA. They don't have anyone that saw him. They have no pictures. They have no photographs.
Well, they got his DNA on the bar in the bathtub, though.
As a matter of fact, that is not the situation. They brought in a different expert to say, well, there could have been, even with this drop-off, I can interpret that to be his DNA, not the son's, whose same DNA it was. I don't think that expert's going to be believed by the jury.
So you don't think that adds up to his DNA? The state's expert says it is his DNA.
A violent scene, Aaron, with all these places. There's no DNA anywhere of his.
But it was on the bar, and he said he wasn't there. So, Bernarda, does that mean he should be convicted?
Given
you don't know if you want to go that far.
No, because there are a lot of holes in this case. But
I agree.
Why the prosecution has steadfast said that this is the guy. No matter who else confesses to it, this is the guy. Because they have motive, means, and opportunity. They have testimony that he had a .32 caliber gun, and that's the same make and model of the ballistics that were found at the scene. And he also has access to the scene. He also asked his friend for a gun prior to this homicide. So I can see why they stayed with him as being the person who committed this massacre.
You know, Linda, we've got all these items, all these gloves in his trash barrel. It gets set on fire. We've got the drug cartel allegations. We've got Santos. We've got other people alleged to have been involved in the killing, testifying from Italy. Talk about a case with all sorts of elements. This has not been a quick verdict. The jury's been at it for several hours.
And that's why you had an 8-4 verdict, mostly in favor of acquittal in the first trial, and it may be the same in the second trial.
Yeah, so much to talk about in this case. We're going to move along, though, because still ahead tonight here on The Debrief, local criminal cases we're watching, including the jury selection in the trial of a husband accused of murdering his doctor wife, plus reaction to the verdict and the sentence for a Colorado man convicted of killing his fiancée, Kelsey Barrett. Those cases and others when we return. Jury selection is complete in the death penalty trial of a Florida man accused of murdering his wife. Authorities say a group of three men conspired to beat Dr. Teresa Severs to death in her own home with a hammer, and that her husband and business manager Mark Severs was the ringleader. Co-defendant Curtis Wright pleaded guilty. A jury convicted co-defendant Jimmy Rogers after Wright testified against him. Opening statements in Mark Severs' case are scheduled for tomorrow. We are also tracking the case of a Missouri husband charged with killing his wife. Beau Rothwell is accused of tampering with physical evidence and second-degree murder in the death of Jennifer Rothwell. Police think they found her body near St. Louis overnight. Court documents say police have surveillance video showing the husband buying carpet cleaner, gloves, and bleach the day before he reported his wife missing. A Colorado jury has convicted a man accused of murdering his fiancée, Patrick Frazee, serving life plus 156 years in the death of Kelsey Barrett. Crystal Lee, Frazee's girlfriend on the side, testified that he asked her to kill Barrett several times, and when she chickened out, he did it himself and asked her to clean up the blood. Surveillance footage proved Frazee lied about his whereabouts, the day that Barrett disappeared. He said he'd been to her place once. The video showed him coming and going 11 times. Plus, prosecutors presented evidence that Frazee tried to tamper with evidence and even asked someone to kill witnesses like Lee so they couldn't talk. The judge refused to allow cameras, live tweets, and even a sketch artist in that Colorado courtroom. But reporter Jennifer Meckles was there watching for KUSA-TV in Denver. She spoke with the Law and Crime Network today about the case.
Shortly after the verdict was read, we immediately moved into sentencing, and the emotion in that room was much clearer. There were family members of the victim in the courtroom, Kelsey Barrett's father and her uncle and a few other people who cared about her. And her mother and her brother were not in the courtroom. They lived out of state and had dialed in during the sentencing. The victim's mother, Cheryl Barrett, had a statement as well. She called Kelsey saying she was our daughter, a devoted, loving mother, a sister, a friend, and a valued pilot teaching military how to fly. She was a positive contribution to society, beautiful inside and out. The family is interested in setting up an aviation scholarship in their daughter's name. They're also a family with a pretty great faith, and they made a point in that statement to say that they, as a family, did not support the death penalty in this case. The prosecution did not pursue the death penalty in this case, but the family, we now know, supported that decision. They said, we respect life, and we leave Patrick's in God's hands. It is not ours to take.
Bernarda and Linda back now to discuss this case. So some strong words there during the sentencing, and it gives us, Bernarda, a more full look of the family of Kelsey Barrett. It's been so hard to try to explain what's going on in this case because of the restrictions that the judge placed on the proceedings. So it's been hard to track. It's been hard to report.
Yeah, it's definitely hard when you're not allowed to even to have like a sketch artist there or someone being able to tweet information out about what's actually going on in the courtroom. We can only assume by what we hear later on afterwards about what took place in the courtroom. But it seems like this family is a very forgiving family and a loving family, and that finally they got justice, the justice they've been waiting for.
And we didn't get to tell that side of the story in real time. And it's sad to think of that, because oftentimes once things go into sentencing, cameras can be allowed. Linda, the evidence against this particular defendant seemed relatively strong going into things. I was sitting here questioning, well, is Crystal Lee, you know, telling the truth? What's she really have against him? Because prosecutors played this close to the vest. But once we got into things, the evidence just started piling up. And when it piled up, it piled up. You've got Patrick Frazee writing letters asking for somebody to kill Crystal Lee in his handwriting, and they go into evidence.
And to his, and a jail cell person, another cellmate, not a mate, but someone in jail, 21 letters to kill various people, including Crystal Lee. It just, the evidence was so strong against him. But I would want to say one thing. This is kind of like the Chris Watts case, where the family also didn't want the death penalty in Colorado. Forgiveness and mercy, but justice at the same time, and justice would be life imprisonment. And it, the remarkable nature of families in this just... you know, to my heart starts to flutter.
You know, forgiveness can play a role in judicial proceedings. The law says one thing, and forgiveness doesn't necessarily say the other, Bernarda. Oftentimes they can work in conjunction, and that's what we saw here.
Yeah, you saw the compromise here. He was sentenced to life in prison.
We don't know exactly what happened to right. Kelsey Barrett. We have a sense based on the testimony.
Right.
The testimony was ultimately that this testimony coming from Crystal Lee, that she basically was burned. They never found a body. They
right.
searched. They found accelerants. They found a little bit, but no final piece for her, perhaps, other than the words that are coming through her family.
That's exactly right, Aaron. And again, it just points out also with all the cases we cover here on Law and Crime, the amount of domestic violence leading to women's deaths, whether they're in a relationship, whether they're married, and who have young children with the person who killed them, is just unbelievable. I don't know if it's gotten worse or what's happened out there, but it's something we need to address in this country.
Or we're paying more attention to it, and that may be
right.
the first step. Thanks a lot to both of you for joining us here on The Debrief. That's all the time we have for today. We'll see you back here tomorrow at 5 p.m. on The Debrief.